Emotions are where the mojo is. The emotions are worthy of exploring and leaning into, as opposed to trying to lean away or stop. You know, oftentimes people will, when the emotions kind of rise up, people will want to take a break. They're so flooded with, you know, with the adrenaline that they can't think. Okay, now we need to take a break because the brain literally needs to reset. But if it's just that the actual feelings are coming up, then people are going to say their truth. Often they're going to say their truth because they're upset.
The Center for Understanding and Conflict welcomes you to The Other Chair, a monthly podcast exploring the dynamics of conflict and how to bring the human issues to the table. Together with our guests, we explore how the power of understanding each other can lead to better solutions for people on both sides of an issue. We will also share tips for managing your own mediation practice, approaching conflict in the professional world, and ways to apply our understanding-based model in your personal life. Hello to our listeners, and welcome to The Other Chair. My name is James Dykman. Today's guest is Catherine Miller, director and trainer at the Center for Understanding and Conflict, and an attorney practicing mediation and collaborative practice in Westchester County, New York. Subject of today's episode is working with emotions in mediation, including emotions in the room and the emotional reactions of the mediator. Hello, Catherine, and welcome to The Other Chair.
Thank you, James. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you and to be able to bring your expertise in this area to our listeners. So let's just jump right in. Emotions in mediation. What have you seen in your work as emotions come into play in the atmosphere of the mediation room, and what sort of dynamics unfold between parties in conflict?
Well, it's really an interesting thing because emotions, of course, play a big part in any conflict, right? So oftentimes we think about mediation in the context of divorce, but it's also in an employment situation or a conflict between partners or in any place where there's conflict, there's feelings, because if there weren't feelings, the conflict wouldn't be that hard to resolve. And so it kind of comes up and it feels like it's an impediment to a resolution. And, you know, sometimes lawyers are fond of saying, you know, if it weren't for these clients and their feelings, we could resolve this in 5 minutes. And so oftentimes I think lawyers think about emotions as being a problem in the negotiation room because they are so, hijacking of the people in their effort to reach a resolution that feels fair. So that's one piece of it. Another piece of it is that, of course, as mediators and lawyers and other professionals in the room, but since this is the Other Chair podcast, you know, let's talk about the mediator and the feelings in the mediator. Of course, the mediator being a human being has feelings. And if there are mediators out there thinking, well, not I, when I am sitting in the mediator's chair, I don't have feelings. Frankly, that's BS, because of course we do. We're human beings. And so that is by definition a part of who we are. And if you suppress those feelings, then they just come out in other ways. And so I just want to distinguish for the purposes of this conversation, emotions that happen inside the mediator and emotions that happen outside the mediator is person in the room with the parties and the dynamic between those two things. It also turns out, James, that the way our brains are structured, that decisions are made in the emotional part of our brain, not in the rational part of our brain. So oftentimes when we think we're making a rational decision, we're deciding to do what we want to do because that's what our emotions tell us to do. And then we're rationalizing it. So this idea that we're coming to a rational decision, no, that's not exactly accurate. And so I just thought it's kind of an interesting thing to think about those different places in which emotion show up in the room.
And speaking from a traditional perspective, you know, a lot of mediators consider themselves a neutral. They pride themselves in, you know, being impartial in a room to a certain degree. In your experience, how often do you find that mediators think that they're staying centered and logical and neutral when in reality their emotions are starting to creep in and maybe influencing what's happening in the room?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I was just talking about this with somebody yesterday. I think the idea of neutrality and impartiality, meaning that we don't have feelings, is just a mistake or a misunderstanding of how we work. And in the centers model and the understanding-based model, One of the things that we talk about and teach about and in the way that we work is thinking of neutrality as being equally close to the parties as opposed to equidistant. So this idea that we're disinterested is really, it's maybe true in terms of disinterested in the result. We don't have an economic interest with one person or the other person prevailing or winning or what the result might be, but we're going to be emotionally invested in helping them come to some kind of resolution often and feel that we have an emotional engagement too. We're going to feel closer to one at some times and closer to the other at another time. We might have dislike someone, or we might think that something's the right result. So I think that the idea of thinking of neutrality and this being close to both people is in this idea of neutrality is to lean in instead of lean out to our feelings. So when I'm sitting in the mediator's chair, just as an example, and I notice that I am having a feeling about what someone has said or a position that they're taking or something that they're demonstrating, I think to myself, well, what's going on with that? You know, what's going on with that for me? And, you know, why am I having that response? And what's going on for that person? And if I find like I don't like something that's happened, it's an emotional response of dislike or revulsion in some way. I find myself in judgment of them. Then I think, well, what can I get curious about that for me? And can I get curious about that for them? Like, so if I were in their shoes and I were saying what that person is saying or doing or acting or being, what would lead me to do that? And if I can, not that I'm sort of trying to put myself over them, but that curiosity allows me perhaps to understand and inquire from that party or both parties from a place of wanting to understand, leaning in, as opposed to being like, you know, I'm just going to pretend that didn't happen or pretend that I don't have a reaction to that and trying to distance myself outside of the room.
Conflict manifests itself in many ways in our personal lives, for professionals in the workplace and for practitioners who have made a career bringing together parties in conflict through mediation practice. Each month, the Center for Understanding and Conflict hosts live webinars with featured guests discussing best practices and sharing their experiences for tackling conflict using the understanding-based model.
To those that haven't trained specifically to develop the emotional intelligence to realize when their emotions are starting to come into the room as a mediator, are there some telltale signs or triggers that one could be aware of that might signal to them that they're starting to become emotionally involved in what's happening?
Well, we almost all have a physical response when that's kind of happening, right? And so we're feeling tense and we tense our jaw or our breathing gets shallow or we're clenching our fists or something like that is happening. Certainly we all recognize when we don't like something or we do like something, you know, so just checking in with yourself on a periodic basis and saying, hey, how am I feeling right now? How do I feel sitting here on the chair? And if I'm feeling anxious or tense or worried, then I find that a couple of things that I like to do. One is just to take 3 breaths and to think about it and just to pause, you know, and just breathe for the count of 3. And another one that I really like is to think about how it feels to sit in the chair, assuming I'm sitting. And how does it feel? Where is my weight distributed? Just to get some sense of literal grounding of my own body and a sense of checking in with myself. Now, you might be thinking, or the listeners might be thinking, well, isn't the mediation supposed to be about the parties and not about the mediator? And the answer to that, of course, yes, it is about the parties, but the mediator is there in the room. And I think there's something from physics called the observer's effect. And the observer's effect basically says that no matter what it is that a person is observing, the act of observing changes what's happening in the petri dish or what's happening in the dynamic. Even if what's being observed doesn't know that it's being observed, that the act of observing changes it. certainly in mediation, the act of being mediation changes the dynamic between the parties and changes the dynamic in the room. And so the mediator, of course, is a part of that mediation in a way, and being aware of the influence that the mediator is having, for the mediator to be aware of her own influence in the room and the impact of what's happening in the room on her, because it's a cyclical effect, James. So, right, what's happening in the room impacts the emotional experience of the mediator, and the emotional experience of the mediator, knowing or not, impacts what's happening in the room because it impacts our reactions. And so if I'm aware of my own emotional reaction, my own emotional experience about what's happening in the room, then I have a lot more control over how I'm giving it back into the room. So if I'm upset by something, or I notice that before I just react, and I give myself a moment to say, wow, you know, I'm upset by that, whatever that means to you or to the listeners or to me, what's going on? Then that's really useful information for me in terms of choosing how I'm going to respond to it. But it's also really useful information to me about what's going on for the people in the room, whether or not it's two parties or multiple parties or attorneys or anything like that. And so that I often think of myself as a tuning fork emotionally, you know, that if I'm feeling this way, I'm not the only one feeling it, and that it's in the room. And one of the things that we talk about in the understanding-based model is reflecting the dynamic back. So if I'm feeling this way, then other people are probably feeling this way. And it might be helpful to bring that out and talk about it and say, wow, you know, it feels like there's a lot of tension in the room right now. What's going on? You know, should we talk about that? Or it feels like something really, really just happened here. And I feel like that the emotional space changed radically. And that happens a lot, like that there's a moment and then the energy, the emotional energy just switches from high to low, low to high. And you don't necessarily know what happened, but if you can say, I feel that this just happened, you know, can we talk about it? That makes the implicit explicit. And often in those moments, you have a real exposure of what's really happening for the people. And I think that if I could just change the conversation back to the outside of the mediator for a minute, you know, emotions are difficult sometimes, and sometimes emotions get in the way of resolution. It turns out that we're hardwired as humans for a sense of fairness, or at least almost all of us are. The problem is that if you and I are in conflict and I want a resolution that's fair for you and for me, and you want a resolution that's fair for you and for me, we just can't agree on what that is, right? Because I am a little bit more self-interested in what's fair for me is a little bit more on my side of the table. And you're thinking, well, what's fair for you is a little bit more on your side of the table. That's just normal. And so then when people have had this long history, they feel like, well, if you're not seeing me, or you're not hearing me, or you're not appreciating me, then we start to feel, I think, these emotions sort of come up, and what we think of as negative emotions or afflictive emotions, that those cover something of the values of the parties. And if they're willing to explore their own feelings to get to what's underneath it, then some really important information about what's really important for them is there under the emotion. So I think it's really much more important, as I said earlier, to lean into that feeling, to see if they're willing to explore it with you and to tell you what's going on. And by finding out that information, we're really able to get much, much more deeply into the interests of each person and even the meaning that underlies those interests to reach, hopefully, a really meaningful resolution.
Could you illustrate an example of a mediation scenario where we're back in the chair, where the mediator is not attuned to this emotional change in themselves or in the air, and how that can have a negative outcome in the moment when attempting to bring parties together who are in conflict?
Imagine a mediator who feels really invested in getting the parties to a resolution. And rather than being with them at the time that where they are in the process, right? So I can imagine that a mediator who's just not in tune with that could really miss and push a party to reach a resolution that they weren't really bought into, just because the parties really want to please the mediator. And that's often the case. Once there's some trust built in the room, the parties will often want the mediator gains a lot of power. And, you know, and I actually feel like a little cringy even saying that, because of course, as mediators, we don't want to be in a position of power. We want the parties to have the power, but oftentimes, because that relationship of trust builds, the mediator has a lot of trust from the parties, and that gives the mediator power. That I always say to the people who take our programs, this is a power you must use for good and not for evil. But it's so tempting then to use it in your own best interest, the mediator's best interest, like, because I want to get a resolution. A lot of mediators, when you go to conferences, brag, well, 95% of my cases settle. And I'm like, first of all, don't keep those records, because it doesn't really matter. Something that doesn't settle in mediation maybe shouldn't settle in mediation. And maybe that's not the right thing for them. And maybe you as the mediator assume that a resolution is in this direction, but it's really in another direction. And you don't know what that is if you're pushing them to in that one direction. You know, another thing is that the mediation fails because one person, and usually it would be one person, feels completely unheard because the mediator did not want to hear what they were saying, and unaware of it, just saying, "Oh, you know, I got to get through it with this person, and then I'm just going to work with this other person to get through this." And then the person who might be a more difficult person, I'm putting air quotes around that, more difficult for the mediator to deal with, then that person feels and is left out in the cold in terms of allowing their voice to be as fully present in the room as the other person.
Throughout the year, the Center for Understanding and Conflict hosts in-depth, basic, and advanced certificate programs designed to train you to become effective mediators and conflict resolution professionals centered in the understanding-based model. Our training programs have been the gold standard in alternative dispute resolution for 40 years and is popular within the legal community with human resource professionals, ombudsmen, and corporate workplace mediation clients. Speaking of feelings and failure, you know, when a mediation fails versus, you know, those who may be looking to have a high close rate, like, oh, look, I'm solving all these problems one after the other. It sounds like, when being realistic, not all mediations should proceed. And there probably is some inner work that's required for the mediator to accept and understand and not attach their own personal feelings or desires to win or to see a positive outcome that they can stand by. Can you talk a little bit about how a mediator can cultivate that sense of awareness and acceptance for when it's obvious that mediation may not be the best course of action?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things there. One is a kind of a what and one is a kind of a how question, right? So let's start with the what first, because what I mean is that let's say it's a family mediation and a couple comes in and the mediator presumes that they're going to get divorced. And they may be presuming that they get divorced too, but each session is in a progression towards what? Is each session in a progression towards divorce? And that's what's just assumed each session. And you just kind of boom, 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 move along in that way without checking in with them. And each time, what are we going to do today? Is this still what we're going? Is this still where we are? And I remember a mediation years ago that we got all the way to a drafted separation agreement. And these people were having really issues about money. You know, it's a pretty common thing in a divorce situation. And they had enough money to live their lives, but he really wanted to save for retirement, save, except he had one thing he really liked to spend money on. And she was just like, I'm fine saving for retirement. It's just like, what's life worth living if we don't go to the occasional concert or restaurant? You know, I want to be able to enjoy my life too. And she was going through a really difficult time at work. I mean, and it was really terrible. And they would come to mediation after work. And we would spend the first 10 minutes or so while she would talk about her day. And he was very empathetic and compassionate and supportive to her. And then, you know, just one day, James, it just occurred to me, you know, maybe these people shouldn't get divorced. And I said, before they'd signed the agreement, when we were going over the draft, I said, you know, if you could work out the money on this, would you want to stay married? And they were like, yeah. And I'm like, well, I think we can do that. And we just took a turn, like, you know, like, okay. And we did. And I said, all right, so let's work on the budget. And we just worked out the budget that allowed the occasional concert and allowed saving for retirement. And it allowed the hobby that the husband had. And they're still married. You know, I'm sure they've evolved their budget from the one we worked on 10 or 12 years ago. So there's that, you know, be here now. And also in the mediation sessions, it can feel like you need to make substantive agreement progress, but often there's also emotional processing that has to happen. The whole purpose of this podcast is about emotions, right? And so sometimes you'll come to a session where they just have to work through some emotional stuff, regardless of what the conflict is. And they just have to talk about their feelings in order to clear the air so that they can move to that. And those sessions are often really tough on the parties because they feel like sort of been through the emotional ringer. And sometimes they feel angry at themselves or even at the mediator because we didn't make any progress today. And what I say to them is, listen, I think this was one of the most valuable sessions we've had because these feelings that you have come up every time we're talking about the substantive issues and they're in the way. And so now that we've had a chance to clear the air, it's helpful to me to know what's going on for each of you. And I think it's helpful for you to have had a chance to talk about it. So I don't think we're going to come in and keep having this same session over and over. And they often look at me and say, well, thank you for saying that because, you know, I wasn't exactly sure what we were doing here today. And that's because mediation, you know, there is a lot of a feeling that comes up in this conflict and that feeling needs to be processed. And it's unrealistic to think that it isn't going to be processed in some way inside the mediation room or outside the mediation room, but it's definitely got to do that. Now, then there's the idea of, is mediation the right process? And is this the right mediator for these people, for this situation? And you know, there are some situations in which mediation just isn't a good idea. You know, when there's domestic violence or when there's such a big power imbalance that if the people are in the room without attorneys, you know, it really is just going to be a steamrolling of one person over the other. And there's some things that the mediator can do to bring some leveling to the playing field because it's, you know, it's never going to be perfectly level. And in various conversations, there's going to be a different power imbalance. But to be aware of that and to be aware of the mediator's own response to that, there are things that can happen. But there are circumstances, James, when mediation just isn't the right process and to try to push through because yay, mediation isn't always a good idea. And another thing is if the mediation is just circling the drain, session after session after session after session, same conversation. You know, I think that the mediator has an obligation to say, wow, this is the fourth session, third session, fifth session. We're having the same conversation. You know, what can we do to break this pattern and break this dynamic that I seem to have become a part of too? You know, and maybe the one thing that we can do to break that pattern is to try to resolve this conflict in a different setting, or maybe not. Maybe it's we can change the conflict pattern in the mediation, but we're not going to do it if we're not willing to talk about it.
This podcast is supported by our CUC Connect members, whose yearly membership includes free attendance to our live monthly webinars, 12 additional featured recordings of past training events, discounts to our basic and advanced training programs, and support from our network of certified trainers for continued professional development. Consider joining CUC Connect today and dive deeper into the understanding-based model. So you talk about how sometimes, and it sounds like this could happen on two different ends of the spectrum. In the beginning, there could be a lot of emotional baggage that needs to be unpacked and dealt with that may in and of itself provide the keys to a potential solution. And then it sounds like it may spin around in circles and reach a point where that then needs to happen at the end because they're not having any success. But what sort of cultural implications come into play, or how as a mediator do you address cultural considerations when parties who are struggling with that very issue may be in a place culturally from their background where bringing those emotions out, especially in a public setting or at all, might not be something that they do because of the culture that they come from? How do you work within that?
With humility. Because I just don't know, right? I mean, I just don't know what I don't know. And I think that the most dangerous thing, I said this earlier, really, is assuming I do know. You know, I was kind of on the opposite side of this. I remember, again, a long time ago, I had a couple in mediation. They both came from different cultures, both not American born, but both are high conflict cultures. Like what I think, people are willing to put it out there. When I come from a family where, you know, we didn't do that. And so they would like yell at each other and call each other names. And, you know, and I'd be like, you know, I'm not sure mediation is the right process for you. And they're like, yes, this is great. And I'm like, well, maybe I'm not the right mediator for you. No, no, this is fantastic. You're doing an amazing job. And I'm like, yeah, I am ridiculously uncomfortable. And I would imagine myself kind of going out of my office, pushing the button for the elevator, going down, getting coffee. Was I going to have the small or the large? You know, how much milk, sugar? No, probably not. You know, this is like in my mind, like, I'm like, just get me out of here. And ultimately, they did come to a resolution. And it was a big wake up call for me that my discomfort or comfort has really nothing to do with what's happening for them and to be aware of what's happening for them. So, you know, on the opposite, so that's actually easier, right? So they're high conflict, they're putting it all out there and I'm observing that I'm uncomfortable because their dynamic is difficult for me. Okay, then I just have to get my own together, right? And deal with it. It's harder when it's the dynamic that you're talking about, right? Where someone is unwilling to or culturally trained not to to speak their truth. And if, again, if there's two cultures in the room and there's a clash of culture, right, there as well, that creates a dynamic that is something that it's really important to keep the mediator's eyes and ears open to see and not just to assume that they're like I am or like you are. And to see what's kind of happening. And then again, to be able to reflect it back and to ask what's going on here. Is there something that is, you know, I can do to be more helpful? How can we have a situation where both people can have a voice in the room in a way that feels comfortable for them, but that really brings them into this negotiation in a way that works? Or is that not possible, right? You know, sometimes bringing lawyers into the room really can create a supportive environment and the lawyer can give voice or prime the pump for the party to give voice to something that he or she might not feel comfortable giving voice to on his or her own without that kind of support.
The last question I have for you is a two-part question. What is a concrete takeaway that someone who's in conflict resolution or mediation work who's not used to approaching it from this perspective in relation to emotions, what is a concrete takeaway that they can use to be aware of their own emotions in the moment in a mediation room? And then what's one thing that they could use to encourage the parties who are in conflict to open up or to at least be willing to allow emotions to take a place in the mediation process?
An answer to both of parts of that question is to not be afraid of the emotions, right? That the emotions are where the mojo is, and that the emotions are worthy of exploring and leaning into, as I said at the beginning of this recording, as opposed to trying to lean away or stop. You know, oftentimes people will, when the emotions kind of rise up, people will want to take a break. And by people, I mean lawyers in the room will be like, let's take a break. This is uncomfortable. And that, yeah, sometimes people do. They're so flooded with, you know, with the adrenaline that they can't think, okay, now we need to take a break because the brain literally needs to reset. But if it's just that the actual feelings are coming up, then people are going to say their truth. Often they're going to say their truth because they're upset, and that's super valuable information. And if we can lean into that and we can encourage people to feel what they feel, not to indulge themselves in anger and vitriol and, you know, that kind of talk. I'm not saying that, but to really be truthful and honest in the room and brave enough to say their truth, their feelings building up like that can give them that sense. And then in terms of our own as mediators feelings, don't deny that they're there. Explore them and think about it, you know, and think to yourself, maybe not in the moment, it takes practice to do this, you know, but later on, like if you could find 10 or 15 minutes to journal about, you know, what's up with that? You know, wow, I felt really X, you know, fill in the blank. What is up with that? Like, what happened for me in a non-judgmental way? You are not a bad person for having feelings. You're not a bad person for judging one or both of the parties. We all do it. The question is, what do we do with it? And it can be actually really, really valuable information. Your own judgment can be something really valuable that can use to help the parties, but we got to be willing to understand that our judgment is not the truth. It's only our judgment, and it can change and it can pass, and we can just take it as something that happened, like, wow, a cloud passed over the sun, and move on to something else.
Well, thank you so much, Catherine, for being here today to explore working with emotions in mediation and for sharing your personal experiences. Really appreciate it.
It's been so much fun. Thank you.
Catherine Miller is the author of The New Yorker's Guide to Collaborative Divorce, Untying the Knot with Dignity, Respect, and Compassion. She has taught family law at the White Institute and NYU and lectures regularly on mediation and collaborative practice. You can learn more about Catherine's practice by visiting www.miller-law.com. Thank you to today's guest for being with us today and to our CUC Connect members, whose support enables the Center for Understanding and Conflict to bring new perspectives in the field of conflict resolution and mediation to you, our listener, in each new episode. You can find out more about today's episode, along with full interviews and additional information about conflict resolution and mediation using the understanding-based model at www.understandinginconflict.org.